Hello, and welcome to Wicked True Crime Stories Podcast, the show that will have the hairs on the back of your neck stand up. I'm your host, Alyssa.
And I'm your host, Miranda.
For this case, we are going to take you back to 1964, a case that was so horrific that it led to the birth of 911, the adoption of Good Samaritan laws, and the bystander effect. Our information was gathered from several sources, and like our first episode, the sources will be linked to our podcast on our website, wickedtruecrimestories.com. We gathered information about this case from history.com, psychologytoday.com, britannica.com, simplypsychology.org, npr.org, and pbs.org. If you want more information from these specific articles, visit our website for the links. And here we go. Another Monday and another crazy story. Isn't it fun that we get to do podcasts on our weekends? I just love it.
It's my favorite thing to do on our weekends.
On March 13th, 1964, at around 2:30 in the morning, screams rang out throughout an apartment complex in Queens. A female was screaming for her life while being stabbed by a man with a knife that approached her while she was walking home from work. She was almost home when that man stabbed her after grabbing her while she was running towards her apartment door. Robert Mosier, from his apartment window, yelled out, "Let that girl alone." The attacker ran away.
Did anyone help her?
Well, the terror isn't over yet. The victim was very injured. She crawled toward the back of her apartment building, out of view of any witnesses. About 10 minutes later, her attacker returned, stabbing her, raping her, and stealing her money.
Oh my gosh.
Another neighbor, Sophia Farrar, found the victim and screamed for someone to call the police.
So, Mosier didn't call 911 when he yelled out the window?
No, and guess what? 911 didn't even exist in New York at this time. People just called the police station. Anyways, police arrived several minutes later, and the victim was transported to the hospital by ambulance. She died in the ambulance.
Wow.
Catherine Kitty Susan Genovese was born in 1935 and grew up in Brooklyn, New York. Her parents, Vincent and Rachel Genovese, left Brooklyn after her mother witnessed a murder and moved to New Canaan, Connecticut. Kitty stayed in Brooklyn. She worked two jobs. At night, she was a bartender at Ev's 11th Hour. She later became a manager at this bar and moved to Queens, where the bar was located. According to Simply Psychology article, Kitty Genovese, by Charlotte Rule, states, quote, "Genovese, having just graduated from high school, decided not to follow her family to the suburbs and instead remained in the city with her grandparents to prepare for her upcoming marriage to Rocco Anthony Fazzolari." Is that how you say that?
I think so. It's a hard one.
Unquote. The article also states, quote, "Fazzolari, an army officer and engineer, dated Genovese while he was in college and she in high school. And although the couple did marry on October 31st, 1954, the marriage was soon annulled and the two divorced in 1958, unquote. About 10 years later, Kitty and her girlfriend, Marianne Zielonko, another hard name to pronounce, moved into an apartment together. The morning of the incident around 4 a.m., police inform Marianne Zielonko about Kitty being stabbed and murdered. Later that morning around 7 a.m., a detective named Michael Singh went to their apartment to question Marianne and found her being consoled by her neighbor Carl Ross. Marianne was observed drinking liquor while being consoled. Carl Ross, by the end of the questioning of Marianne, had actually ended up being arrested for disorderly conduct due to the way he was interrupting the questioning.
Do you think that disorderly conduct back then would be considered, I'm trying to think of the words.
Like our interference?
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. It's the same thing, basically. They're trying to investigate something and he was getting in the way of that investigation, and probably because he was intoxicated.
Gotcha.
Eventually, homicide detectives John Carroll and Jerry Burns questioned Marianne for the second time. Most of the questions surrounded Marianne and Kitty's relationship. The questioning also took a very inappropriate turn when the questions began to focus on their sex life. The questioning lasted 6 hours. It came out eventually that the neighbors were also questioned, and the questions focused on, quote, the gay lifestyle, unquote. Marianne Ziolanco was considered a suspect.
Of course.
Yeah, it's not unusual for the significant others to be the first person looked at for a crime like this.
That makes sense.
According to History.com, later in the week after the killing of Kitty, police were called to a possible robbery, where they contacted Winston Mosley. Mosley was found with a television in the trunk of his car and was taken into custody. At the station, he admitted to several other crimes involving stealing items. Mosley's car matched the description of the vehicle a witness saw the suspect in the night of Kitty's murder. And by that, it means he was in a white vehicle and the detective, made the observation that a white vehicle was involved in the murder of Kitty.
Okay.
The detective mentioned this to Mosley, and Mosley didn't say anything. The detective called in the detectives that worked on Kitty's case, and they observed scabs on Mosley's hands. They accused him of killing Kitty. Mosley told him that he did it and knew facts about the crime that only the suspect would know.
Oh my lord.
And it's kind of crazy the way they word it on history.com, because he just like admitted it. He's just like, yeah, I did it.
Wow.
Before Mosley found Kitty, he had been driving around Queens looking for a victim. He saw Kitty at a traffic light as she was walking home from work. He followed her to her apartment building where the violent murder took place. It's crazy to think, but according to history.com, Mosley was married and had 3 young children.
It kind of makes you think about like what goes on at his personal household, that he's driving around Queens in the middle of the night looking for somebody to harm.
Yeah, like how is he towards his family? Right. And also it makes you think like the monster doesn't always look like a monster.
Yeah.
It could look like the average family man or average family woman.
Yeah.
According to history.com, he would later claim that a mobster executed Genovese and he was only the getaway driver. Mosley's son has stated that he believes Mosley attacked Genovese because she yelled racial slurs at him. And again, that's quoted from history.com. According to NPR.org, Mosley was in prison for more than 50 years, making him one of the state's longest serving inmates. He tried for parole 18 times and was denied. He was involved in a prison breakout in 1968. When he escaped, he held people hostage in Buffalo and raped a woman before being recaptured.
So it kind of makes you think, like, when the detectives, all 4 of them, were questioning him and he just outright kind of admitted it. And then later on, after this prison riot breaks out, he basically did the same thing minus, you know, brutally murdering a woman. But it kind of makes you think, is this like his MO again to the whole like a monster doesn't look like a monster thought process? Like, it's just crazy to think that you really truly don't know, you know, the nice neighbors down the street could be people you could never even imagine them being. So I just think that's crazy.
Right. Yeah. And then it's like also crazy that it's just the person he is, I guess. I mean, if he escaped after all that time and, you know, still does the same stuff.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Like, even after being in prison, trying to get out and trying for parole 18 times and was denied, it almost makes you think, what information does the public not have as to why he was denied 18 times? You know, like, have they puzzled him together with other crimes or similar crimes, or, you know, like, was this a two-off thing? Or it just makes you think of what maybe the public hasn't known.
Yeah, and that's a good question to ask, and I'm sure if you dig deep enough there's some information on it. Mosley died in prison at 81 years old, so he was there for a while.
For a long time.
Yeah. So what did we learn from this case? There's something called the bystander effect. After this horrible crime, the New York Times wrote a piece titled, 37 Who Saw Murder Didn't Call the Police. This article alleged that multiple neighbors heard or saw what happened to Kitty, but did nothing about it. Psychologists studied what was dubbed to be the bystander effect, and found that the more witnesses there are, the less likely other witnesses are to help.
That makes sense.
Yeah, and I think this is because other witnesses think that another witness is going to help, or has already called for the police. Think about the times, you know, you have passed a bad car accident. Some people stop and help, but the others probably think to themselves, there's already a person there with them, or someone else called 911, or someone behind me will know what to do, so I don't need to do anything.
I think a lot of witnesses, too, get scared that maybe they're going to do something wrong and, like, hurt the situation rather than help, so they just keep moving along.
And that could be true sometimes, you know. Sometimes they're just in the way, you know,
right,
gawking at what happened and not really helping at all. But, I mean, you could at least try to call 911 or something like that, you know.
That is true.
A lot of witnesses also don't come forward about what they saw. Some don't stick around to talk to police because they figure someone else was there and saw what they saw. But did you know that memory is a tricky thing? And most of the time, you probably saw something that the 10 other witnesses didn't see or don't remember seeing.
Right.
Maybe the suspect was wearing a black ball cap, but no one else saw that because they were too busy looking at the victim. This bystander effect can have some seriously devastating consequences. History.com says in their article, Kitty Genovese, quote, "The New York Times coverage has been criticized for numerous factual errors and accused of contriving a social phenomenon for sensationalistic purposes," unquote. And, quote, "Only two neighbors have been shown to behave at the time of the murder in the way the Times claimed 38 people did. One of those was Carl Ross," unquote.
I wonder where they got all that information that so many people were around when, in reality, like, there weren't that many people.
Right, and a little more about what I read on history.com was that maybe not all of this was true, what the New York Times was saying, in that they were basically trying to, like, push this agenda of, like, people are bad nowadays. Like, no one wants to help. People only care about themselves, kind of stuff like that.
Gotcha.
Ross was reported to be intoxicated, and when he heard the screams from Kitty, he slightly opened his door and observed Kitty lying on the ground, trying to speak and being stabbed by Mosley. He shut his door and called a friend to ask what to do. A friend, not the police. Oh, and guess what the friend told him? Not to get involved.
Oh, wow.
Ross eventually climbed out of his window and went to a neighbor's apartment. He called the police after Farrar yelled for someone to do so. Ross later explained that he didn't want to get involved. This gathered more attention again to the bystander effect.
And it also makes you think, like, he was the one consoling her girlfriend when, like, he could have done a lot more than just close his door and then crawl out the window.
Yeah, he's over there consoling her after he sat there and watched
her girlfriend
being murdered. Yeah. And then he didn't do anything until it was too late, you know? He didn't even try to call. He called a friend. So.
And he was close enough to see that she was trying to speak, which means, like, he could have very well off, like,
At least said something.
Right. Yeah, like, yelled at, you know, Mosley to stop or
right,
something.
Scare him off again. Yeah. According to psychology.com, quote, "The bystander effect occurs when the presence of others discourages an individual from intervening in an emergency situation against a bully or during an assault or other crime," unquote. According to Robert D. Blagg, how do you think that's pronounced? I should probably learn how to pronounce these names.
That's fair.
And sorry if anyone knows who this is, and I'm saying it wrong, but an article on Britannica says, quote, a bystander must notice that something is amiss. Define the situation as an emergency or a circumstance requiring assistance. Decide whether he or she is personally responsible to act. Choose how to help. And finally, implement the chosen helping behavior. Unquote. Not a lot of people run across emergency situations on their daily routes to the grocery store or work. Unless you're me, of course. Do you remember that time we were driving to Colorado to turn in my firefighter application for me, and that construction truck had just crashed?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I do.
Two people were ejected from that, and that was crazy. But I was used to stuff like that from being like a firefighter and EMT and doing first responder type stuff. I just think about how many people probably passed by and thought, I bet emergency personnel are already on their way. I don't need to stop. Thank God that other people had stopped to help. It took several men that also showed up to help lift a heavy piece of the truck off of one of the victims while we removed him from under it.
That's right, because it was like the engine block that landed on his legs. And if it was just you or even you and one other person trying to lift something like that off, you know, a victim is... incredibly, probably wouldn't have happened, but there were so many people that actually did stop to help that, like,
yeah,
it all worked out.
Yeah, and I don't know what that heavy piece of truck was, but it was heavy enough that, like, six or seven of those guys could barely hold it up long enough for us to pull him out. And, you know, it wasn't only on his legs, it was also, like, on his,
like,
you
abdomen.
Know, like, abdomen and stuff. So, yeah. You know, he was struggling under
yeah.
there. He couldn't talk. He was having a lot of issues. So it was really great that other people were like, hey, let's stop
right.
and see what's going on and if we can help.
Yeah.
And if not just that, at least, you know, someone calling 911 to get first responders there in the first
right.
place.
I know I would be if I was by myself and I was driving along and I saw that. I definitely would call 911, but I don't know how to do any of that stuff because I've never been in a first responder's shoes. So I don't know entirely if I would get out and, like, try and help that way, but I know I would at least, like, I'm going to call 911 and make sure that they're aware of the situation.
Sure, and that's the thing. Like, not everybody has to go out and, like, you know, try to defend somebody or try to, like, rescue somebody.
Right.
Or anything like that. You know, the least you can do is call 911 and, you know, maybe people have already called, but you don't know that for sure.
Right.
And you might be that one person that called to get the attention of this accident.
Right.
So now let's talk about this whole non-existing 911 thing. I guess if I really think about it, I knew that 911 and dispatch centers didn't used to exist. I mean, if you think back to, like,
right.
way back in, like, the 1400s or whatever, there probably wasn't, obviously, a 911 or dispatch
right.
center. You would just call your local police station or fire station to get help. Imagine only having one deputy working in a small town and he or she is on another call and can't take yours. And in some cases, probably doesn't even know you ever called. So you just never get a police response. According to PBS.org, there was no centralized 911 until the late 1960s.
Wow.
Besides calling the nearest local station, there was also the option to dial zero and be connected with an operator that would connect you to a local police station. That isn't the same as a dispatcher center, though, because the operator isn't there for specifically emergency situations. They just connect you with who you need. Then you still have to wait to be connected with a law enforcement officer to begin making your report, which I'm guessing they did not have a particular script to follow to get the right type of information that they needed about the incident being reported. Now, 911 centers normally follow some sort of script to get the information they need from the caller. And as they're gathering the needed information, they dispatch it out to police officers that respond to the call. For places that have a dispatching center, the officer doesn't take the initial call. So this case really shedded some light on the need for 911. If you feel like getting involved in attempting to stop a crime will put you in danger and you don't want to be in danger, then there are other ways of being an active bystander and possibly saving someone's life. Call 911. even if people are passing by and you think they are calling 911, call 911 anyways. They will tell you that they've already received multiple reports if that is the case. Shout something from far away, like, hey, what's going on? Or, I'm calling the police. Sometimes when one person stands up to stop something, more people will step up. The more people that stand against a crime, the better the chances are it will stop. This also applies for emergencies that are not assaults on other people, like the example I gave of vehicle accidents or maybe someone having a medical emergency. Call 911, get others' attention. Maybe someone knows how to help them. Keep people calm, give direction to others so that people are not just scrambling around making a mess and getting in the way. When law enforcement and emergency personnel get there, listen to what they tell you, stay out of their way, and if they have questions, they will ask you. If they don't talk to you on scene because they are busy, you can call a non-emergency number later and tell them you have more information. If you have details about a suspect that fled the scene or details about what happened before the crime, that could be helpful. Be active. You don't have to put yourself in harm's way to help other people, but you can do something. Anything to help your fellow people. What are your thoughts on this case, Miranda?
So, I personally think that this case is a double-edged sword. You know, what happened to Kitty was horrific, and she didn't deserve any of that. She was minding her own business, going home after a long days of work, not expecting anything to happen. But if you think about it, 911 didn't come to exist until after this case. And now, look at the impact the use of 911 has. I mean, every dispatch center gets hundreds of calls, you know, daily, weekly, monthly. And crimes are actually being dealt with. Like, before 911, you know, you may, like you said, you may not even be in contact with a law enforcement officer. They might not even know that you even called. So with it coming to light and, you know, dispatch centers opening up, law enforcement officers having jobs, it has definitely changed the world in the sense of, you know, criminals don't roam the streets and, you know, be vigilantes and do whatever they want. So crimes are being dealt with faster than before, and there have been millions of first responder jobs created. I mean, you have the dispatcher, police officers, you know, firefighters, EMTs, paramedics, all those people that now have careers and jobs in this line of work. And, it might not have ever come to exist if, you know, horrible crimes like this didn't happen. I think it's also an eye-opening case in the bystander effect, kind of psychologically thinking about it. And it also ties into, you know, eyewitness statements, memory loss, like, you know, different types of eyewitness testimonies and how degraded memory affects that kind of thing. Because if one person thinks, like, I don't need to help, I'm sure someone else is already helping, and say that person sees someone running towards or away from what is happening, they could potentially have seen the suspect, and by not stopping and helping, you know, in any way that that could mean, by calling 911, by mentally making a note of everybody you see, that sort of thing, it could lead to a lot of dead ends for law enforcement. So if you saw something like the black ball cap example you gave and nobody else saw that, but you just simply assumed because there were 15 other people around, somebody did, and you saw the suspect and that was the key thing that they needed to know, then they're not going to know that because you didn't say anything. So I think that, you know, like I said, it was a horrific crime. She didn't deserve it. Nobody does. But a lot of good things happened because of it, if that makes sense.
Right, yeah, and it does. And you mentioned that, like, now there's a lot of jobs with the dispatching centers for people calling, or people answering the phones for 911 calls or for not even, like, non-emergency calls. And yeah, like, so before that, you know, we had some sort of law enforcement or some sort of people that, you know, did stuff to try to control the towns.
Right.
And you had some sort of fire department in a way, or at least people with buckets putting out fires, stuff like that, you know. But it all comes more together and we're all more on the same page, and things flow a lot easier when we have dispatchers now.
Yeah.
And it's just easier for all of us to work together now and make sure we have what we need, because we have that one centerpiece,
right,
that really ties everything together, which right. is dispatch or 911. This case is frightening in several ways, though. First of all, some creeper follows her home, stabs her, gets scared away, comes back, stabs her again, rapes her, and steals her stuff. Second of all, people heard the screams. One person even opened his door and saw this horrible act taking place right in front of him, close enough to notice that Kitty was trying to talk, but he didn't do anything. He called his friend to ask what to do and didn't call the police until the suspect was already gone, and only because Farrar had yelled for someone to call. And there's also another person that, you know, in the beginning we said he yelled at it out his window to
Robert Mosier.
Leave that girl alone. Yeah.
Yeah.
And he still, you know, he didn't do anything.
He
like
all now, he yelled now was this, out the window.
Yeah, now this guy took off and this girl is hurt, you know, and nothing's being done.
Right.
And then third of all, 911 didn't exist, making reporting a crime, especially an emergent one, hard to do.
Right.
I learned a lot from this case and enjoyed sharing it with our wicked listeners. As always, leave us feedback, comments, and questions, and if you want them shared on our podcast, we will do that. Listen in next Monday for another wicked true crime story. Bye.
Bye.